This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 66, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. If you want to hear the extended version of this episode, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now over 60 episodes in the back catalogue. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. And this week I'm talking to Terry Lovelace about his book, Devil's Den, The Reckoning. Terry is a six-year veteran of the United States Air Force, where he served as a medic and EMT from 1973 to 1979. He has a bachelor's degree in psychology with honours from Park University in Kansas City. He was Assistant Attorney General for the U.S. Territory of American Samoa. In 2012, a routine leg x-ray discovered two anomalous objects in his leg. That event was his catalyst to write two books and speak publicly about his experiences. His abduction story was featured in the UK newspaper The Guardian on September 12, 2021. He's spoken at the UFO Congress in 2018, Contact in the Desert in 2019 and 2021, the Roswell UFO Festival in 2019, UFO Con in Dallas, Alien Con in San Francisco, the Ascension Conference in Sedona, and the Ozark Digital Conference. Since March 2018, he's been a radio podcast guest more than 100 times. Hi, Terry. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're going to be talking about your book, Devil's Den, The Reckoning, because we've already talked about your other book, all about Devil's Den and what happened to you there. When you talk about when you were age seven, and you would have four monkeys come into your room and they were wearing paper masks with grins painted on them?
I know that, you know, that sounds crazy. That just sounds, is hard to accept. But I'm telling you, when I was six and seven, I would have these, I called them the monkey men. And they would appear in my room, you know, once or twice a month, maybe twice 1 week, and then I wouldn't see them for a while. I saw them as kind of comical at first. And after I published that book, Incident of Devil's Den, I got emails from people all over the world saying, you know, when I was a kid, I saw, you know, deer, raccoons, all kinds of Disney characters, cartoon characters like the Flintstones. And I think that these things have the ability to appear to a child in a way that the child will find most benign. It won't scare the child. In the beginning, they didn't scare me. But after a while, they did. It did start to scare me a lot. There was a dream I'd have, and I'd had this nightmare as recently as last year. And in this nightmare, I'm in my room, and these monkeys would communicate with me telepathically and say, Terry, won't you come with us? Let's go play. You know, there's a poem in the front of Incident at Devil's Den that I wrote that really kind of sums up what they did. But in this nightmare, I see the monkeys in my room and they're holding out a paw to me, asking me to take their paw and go with them. And in the dream, I see the paw and then I look back down and it's not a paw. It's these four ugly gray fingers. And I just flip out. That's just too much for me to process in a dream. And I, you know, every time I have the dream, I know it's coming. I know it's going to be at the end of the dream. And then I'll wake up, but I have no control over it.
And so was there a thing where every time you saw them, or sometimes when you saw them, it was like it was the first time you'd seen them? Like they were able to take the memory of them away?
I think they took a lot of memories away, but maybe when I was six, by the time I was seven, I was expecting them. I knew who they were. You know, I think I disclosed in the book about the big round room.
Yeah.
When I'd go with them, where we would go. Where we would go would be when they would take me from my room, I would be in a big round white domed room with a gray padded floor, like rubberized padded floor. And there would be the same group of kids every single time. And we were all dressed in our night clothes. I didn't know these kids. I mean, they weren't from preschool. They weren't from the neighborhood. I didn't know them. And I don't know where they came from. There was a being there I called Sue back then. I named her after we had an Asian neighbor from Japan. She reminded me of our neighbor, Sue. So I called her Sue. Other kids called her different things. But she was kind of like a maternal figure to us kids when we were in this playroom. And there was stuff there for us to play with, but it wasn't toys in the classical sense of the word. There were these colored geometric figures, like a pyramid, a globe, a cube, on and on. And they were all painted different colors. They looked like they were made out of styrofoam. When you picked one up, it was really weird because you'd pick it up and it had absolutely no mass. I mean, if you held it in your hand, you couldn't feel it against your skin because I guess it weighed nothing. But what Sue would have us do is we kids would be sitting around in a circle, and we'd all have our, you know, I had a blue pyramid out in front of me, and everybody had their, what they were supposed to move out in front of them. And she told us she wanted us to try to move it with our minds. And it was presented as a game. And some kids did it right away. I wasn't one of them. I did manage to get mine to move. And, you know, I got high praise from Sue for doing that. I always thought that was strange. I thought that was too strange to put in the first book just because it just is the kind of thing the reader's going to say, oh, come on. But there is a woman named Deborah Cauble, K-A-U-B-L-E, who was a patient of the famous psychologist from New York City.
Is that Bud Hopkins?
It was Bud Hopkins. She was one of Bud Hopkins' subjects. She's had lots of experiences, kind of on an ongoing basis, very similar to my story. And I spoke at the UFO Congress in Arizona in 2019. And she came up to me after I spoke and she says, you know, let's go to dinner because I got a story I got to tell you. We went to dinner. Now, I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, but eventually moved to Michigan. She was a native of Michigan. And she told me when she was four, let's see if I can get her story right. Well, anyway, when she was four, five, and six, they would come and take her too. And she called it trips to the round room or the white room. And same kind of thing, same geometric, you know, objects to move. She told me my story, you know, that I hadn't told in my lecture. And I said, oh my God, we've got a lot in common. And she's like, yeah, I sure think we do. She's got a book out. She's a very credible, very believable woman. She was having terrible nightmares. She saw Bud Hopkins, and Bud Hopkins paid for her trip to New York City. During under hypnosis, she talked about being routinely abducted, just like I was, very similar to my case. After I published Devil's Den, The Reckoning, I got probably 25 emails, which I think is a lot, from people who said, they used to come and take me too. And we'd go to the round room. And she says, oh, they would say, oh yeah, this happened to me. Whatever happened to us, I think it's real. You know what I don't know, and what I wish I did know, was what was the object of the exercise? What were they training us to do? Or were they just experimenting on us? I don't know.
Because wasn't there another girl there that you called her Jenny, but she wasn't quite human?
Yes, there was a girl there named Jenny who absolutely was frightening. And all of us kids stayed away from her. And she looked like a 10-year-old girl, but she was dressed in clothing right out of the 1940s. She had the white socks and black patent leather shoes, and a real short skirt that the little girls wore back then with the puffy sleeves. And she just looked out of date, out of place. And what was so frightening about Jenny was, and she carried a jump rope in her hand, in her left hand always, although I never saw her jump rope. I never saw her do anything with it. And she would just stand around. I think that she looked that way so the kids wouldn't bother her. I think maybe she was some kind of supervisor for Sue or something. I mean, that's a guess. I don't know. But her eyes, she looked like a normal little human girl, except there was no pupil, there was just the white part of your eyes called the sclera. And that's all there was. So when she opened her eyes, all you saw was white, you know, like somebody who maybe had a seizure or something and their eyes rolled back in their head. That's what we saw. Yeah, she was scary.
And something else you mention is that you felt like the monkeys would say to you, yeah, come with us, come with us. And you could say no. They didn't just take you. It's like they couldn't. You had to consent to it.
In the beginning, I absolutely had to consent to it. And they could be very persistent. But there were a few times I said, no, I'm afraid. I don't want to go. I'm going to call for mom or dad. And when I'd say that, they would just disappear. But yeah, it's interesting that they would ask my permission in the beginning. In the very beginning, they were just funny, you know? Sure, I'll go with you and play. But after a while, they became disturbing and I didn't welcome their visits anymore. I think that they knew that. I guess like all children, we outgrow things and I think I outgrew them.
Do you think that your family ever saw them?
No, my family never saw them. I had two sisters across the room, across the hallway from my room. The kids' rooms, we were upstairs, and then the living room, dining room, kitchen was downstairs. And my two sisters shared a room, and I had a small room to myself. When I published this book, Incident at Devil's Den, in 2018, I talked to both of my sisters. And I said, look, I published this book. I gave it a copy to my one sister, and she flat out refused to read it. And she said, no, I don't want to read it. So I don't know if they took her too. So maybe they did see him, but she didn't want to talk about it. The only thing that she said this, there were times at night when we couldn't find you in the house, you know, and there were lights shining in the window and we couldn't find you in the house. But she didn't go into any more detail than that. And my other sister, my older sister, they were 10 and 12 years older than me, respectively. And my older sister, who I still talk to, she has no memory of that house. She can't remember it. I mean, she can remember that, yeah, that was where we lived, but anything that happened in the house is just a blur to her. But she did have a story tell me that surprised me. And that was that when she was 10, my family was living on the other side of the river in East St. Louis, Illinois. There was a row of newly built, very modest homes, kind of carved out of just open field. I was there from the time I was born until I was about 3, when we moved to the other side of the river. My sister said that she and Billy Mulligan, who was the next door neighbor kid, were riding their bikes, and this huge field in back of us, and they would ride these dirt roads just out having fun, like two kids would. She was 12 years old at the time. She and Billy Mulligan were in the same class together, so I assume he was 12 or thereabout. And she said that they saw a silver globe suspended over this field of grass, maybe 50 yards away from them. And it looked like it was about 3 feet in diameter. And it looked like it was rotating. And they both stopped their bikes and they just stared at this thing and they're like, what is it? And they watch it for a minute or two. And she said, then it just shot off. And they rode home like crazy and went in and told their parents. And my dad said, you are not going to tell anybody that story. Don't you dare tell anybody that story. They'll think you're crazy or the police will come and talk to you. Don't you tell anybody that story. And evidently, Billy Mulligan's parents did the same to him, because the two of them never talked about it again.
And was there a time when things changed and you were taken to some other place and there were two big insect-looking beings? What happened there?
You know, the insect-like things, the insectoids, whatever you want to call them, they're big praying mantis-like things, just like the two that were in the exam room that I talk about in Devil's Den. I found out that historically, these insectoid-looking things, they look like praying mantises. They look like, they do not look like anything remotely human. I always picture them wearing white lab coats like doctors, because there's this real clinical, medical vibe from them. Yeah, but they took me, they did an examination to me, and it was painful, and it was scary. It was the first time I'd seen them. Then that was, I think that was my last contact. No, wait a minute, when I was 11, I had the UFO outside my window in January. So I was about 9 then. And that was the end of the monkey men. And this exam that I had by these two bug doctors, that seemed like an end. Put an end to the monkey men, that put an end to, and things were calm. And I thought, you know, maybe this is over for life. And then when I was 11, then I saw the UFO outside my window. And it looked like the one I'd seen in my backyard a couple years before. And I felt very smug about that. You know, I felt like, you know, these things know me. They're coming to see me. And that made me feel weirdly special in some way. And I never told anyone about it.
Was there that time you saw a UFO? And I'm not sure if this is what you're talking about, that same time, but you say the sound kind of changed, almost like everything was muffled around you.
Very dramatically. I was in my backyard in St. Louis, Missouri, and it's a semi-urban area. It's an urban area, really. Old two-story row houses with small backyards. And I was in the backyard, and this was a Saturday, and the windows were open. I could hear my mom's television playing. It was a beautiful spring day, and there were a lot of people outside cutting grass, hanging up laundry. I could hear, you know, kids and cats and dogs and cars and trucks and the usual noises you'd associate with that kind of neighborhood. I was looking down. I was playing with a bow and arrow. I was fitting a notch of an arrow into the bowstring, looking down, and I saw this round shadow move across my feet. And I looked up, and I saw this beautiful silver saucer. And as soon as I laid eyes on it, there was a change, a distinct auditory change. And it sounded like I placed my hands tightly over both of my ears. I could hear a little bit of sound, but they were all muffled. It stayed that way while I watched this thing. I don't know. I think that encounter lasted some minutes. And I had an odd compulsion to lie down and look up at it, thinking I could get a better view of it if I lay down. And that doesn't make any sense. Someone suggested to me, you know, maybe you were taken and you were on the ground because they dropped you down. I don't know. That could be. I don't know. But I watched this thing, and, you know, I thought this was the most, I thought it was the coolest thing. I mean, I don't think the word sexy was in my vocabulary yet, but it was incredibly beautiful in the way that, like, a new sports car on a showroom floor would be. That kind of, like, wow. I watched it, and then it just took off. It shot off 0 to 500 miles an hour, and it's gone. And that's when I stood up and yelled, "Mom!" And I went in and told my mother. And she said, "Now, Terry, I don't know what you saw, but I know you did not see a flying saucer." And I said, "No, Mom, I know what I saw. This was a flying saucer." And she said, "No, Terry, what you saw was a jet or an airplane or maybe a hot air balloon." And she got me a pencil and a piece of paper, and she said, "Here, draw a picture of what you saw." And I drew a circle, and I handed it back to her, and I said, "That's what I saw." My dad got home from work that day, and I guess my mom tipped him off that I'd had some kind of encounter with a UFO or flying saucer, as they said back in the day. And he walked in and he sat down and he said, "Gary, you can't tell people that you saw a flying saucer. If you do, they'll think something's wrong with you. If you do, they'll think something's wrong with us." And I was like, "Oh, I get it. Okay. I won't say a word. Understood." So, different times.
In the book, you talk about your cousin Gerald and about the two clowns.
My cousin Gerald, at the same time I was seeing these monkeys, Gerald was seeing clowns, little circus clowns, 3 foot tall circus clowns. Now, he slept in a room. He had a bed, and then he had two older brothers who slept in bunk beds. These clowns would come and visit him in the middle of the night and take him. The other two boys in the room never saw, never heard a thing. What Gerald did was, Gerald made the mistake of going to his parents and said, "You know, I'm seeing these little clowns in my room, and there's, you know, they were funny at first, but they kind of scare me, and I go with them sometimes." And that didn't play well with my aunt and uncle. They were very strict Southern Baptist, kind of evangelical of sorts. And anything that happened like that, they associated with demonic spirits. They took him to church. You know, the preacher prayed over him. Preacher called him back in the, had a private talk with him and said, "You know, sometimes we think things we shouldn't think." And Gerald looks perplexed, and he's like, he wants to say, like, "Well, you know, what are you talking about?" And then Gerald told me that this guy said, "Yeah, when we have bad thoughts, that's when them demons can come in." So what they did was they turned this whole thing around and put the blame on the kid. His parents said they believed him, but whatever he was saying was demonic in nature. And they weren't happy about having demons in their house. And, you know, they had the house blessed a dozen times. Gerald came to see me. Yeah, a family vacation. The idea of family vacations back when I was a kid was you go see a relative who lives somewhere else. You know, the grown-ups play cards, drink or barbecue or do something fun. And, you know, then the kids play among themselves. And the host provides all the food and water and drink and bedding. You know, 6 months later, then it's reversed. You know, the host becomes a guest. So they would come to my house up in St. Louis, Missouri, and spend 2 weeks with us every year. And then we would go down to northern Arkansas, near Jonesboro, Arkansas, middle of the state, north, and spend 2 weeks with them. So on one of these trips up north, Gerald told me about he told me about the clowns. He already knew about the monkeys, because I guess by this time, I had had nightmares and screamed about the monkeys and the monkey men. And so my mother had already clued in. So Gerald knew that I was seeing monkeys. At the same time, he's seeing these clowns. They came up to see us. And I really felt sorry for this kid. Because I'm like, "What, you know, you told them and they didn't believe you." I said, "Don't, you know, they don't believe me either. So I understand." And he said, "Yeah, but they think they're demons." "Well, I don't know. I don't know if they're demons or not." I said, "Do you think they're demons?" He said, "No, I don't think they're demons. But I know that we both admitted whatever was visiting us was real. And that we were both very disappointed that our parents wouldn't believe us." This caused a lot of problems in Gerald's life. We drifted apart about the time we hit adolescence. When I was in the military, I was about 19 years old. I'd been in about a year, and I found out that Gerald had taken his father's hunting rifle and killed himself. Where's the responsibility for that lie? I mean, I think he was over 18. He knew what he was doing, but boy, it's sure a shame that somebody couldn't recognize that this kid needed help.
Yeah, that's very sad.
So, kind of a sad story, but a true story.
if we move on, I wanted to ask you about this incident you had. You were riding a motorcycle and you were on a nice tarmac road, and then the next thing you knew, you were on gravel?
Yes, I did. I was riding on a two-lane blacktop road. It was autumn, September, October 1987, and I'm riding my bike like I did for entertainment on those. I only rode about 3 months out of the year because I liked the cool weather and riding the bike. It was just fun. And it was a good way for me to clear my head. And I would get up early in the morning, roll the bike down to the street, and then take off and go for a ride. And I had a couple of pre-planned routes that I would drive. One of them was through this windy road that was by a bluff, and then there was huge open cornfields all around. And that's the route that I chose that day. And I was doing about 85 miles an hour, and I shouldn't have been, but I wasn't. I knew that a curve was coming up, and I throttled back to about 60 or so. I blinked. I swear to God, I blinked. And I opened my eyes, and I'm still on my bike, but I'm doing 30 miles an hour, and I'm on a gravel road. I did not understand that at all, because I never took my bike on gravel. Never. I mean, it's dangerous. It's bad for the motorcycle. You know, I don't want to chip my paint job. And I couldn't believe it. And I chalked it up to being absent-minded, because I had a lot of things I was thinking about, as we all do from time to time. And I thought, well, geez, you know, the only explanation I could think of was that I was inattentive and just drove down this farm road. In my conscious mind, I went down and realized I was on a gravel road. I stopped, got off the motorcycle, put the kickstand down, looked around, and then got back on the bike, put my helmet on, and I thought, I'll drive the opposite way that I came in, and I should be back to Blacktop, I hope. And it was. I was just a mile off the Blacktop Road. And in 2017, one of the things that Betty is the same being that I referred to as Sue from my early childhood. At times in my life, and there, I'm not unique in this. I thought that I was, but there are a lot of people that have contact with non-human entities. And that's what Betty was. Now, in 1987, I still knew her as Sue. I got that memory back when I saw her in 2017 in October, when I woke up in my living room and there's this 4 foot tall woman dressed in black, black blouse, black slacks, a red scarf tied around her neck, and her neck was pencil thin. And she had on dark sunglasses, and the sunglass arms were underneath this wig, you know, because she didn't have any discernible ears. And she had on this crazy wig, this crazy black wig. I woke up and I had that sedated feeling that I had at times whenever I've encountered these things. And I said, I wish she'd take those glasses off. I had no fear, no anxiety. As a matter of fact, I felt this semi-sedated feeling like I'd felt back in 77. I thought, I wish she'd take those glasses off. And just right on cue, she reached up and took the glasses off. And I recognized her. And I recognized her as Sue. As the entity that I knew as a kid. But because in 2017, when I saw her, she was wearing this weird wig, I called her Betty, because she reminded me of Betty Rubble, a character from the Flintstones cartoon series in the 1960s. That's where the name Betty came from. I thought to myself, it's nice to see you again. And I heard back with crystal clarity in my head, it's nice to see you, Terry. you know, this is hard to believe, but this is the way these things communicate. They communicate telepathically. I remember as a kid, this would be a good place to tell this story. When I was being taken by the monkey men still and go up to the big round white room, I got scared one day. I started to cry, and Sue came over and said, "Oh, what's wrong?" And just like any human mother would do, she sat on the floor, cross-legged, and put me on her lap and said, "You know, what's wrong?" And we spoke telepathically. When I was in this round room, nobody said an audible word, but we all communicated with our minds. And I asked her at that time, I said, "Why is it I can't communicate like this at home?" And she said, "Because you're not ready to." And I took that to mean, well, oh boy, maybe when I'm 8 or 9, I'll get to do that, you know? But I think she was speaking collectively that humanity is not ready for that. I think about that, and I can't imagine a world where everyone's mind would be an open book. You know, could be a good thing, could be a bad thing, but I think the adjustment time would be terrible. Yeah. I don't think that humanity is ready for that.
Well, there was something I wanted to ask you about with this motorbike incident when you were on the gravel. One of them was that you had 2 hours missing, didn't you? But it's almost like...
I did. And, you know, having missing time is just as if you'd sliced, I don't know, 20 feet of motion picture film and spliced the two ends together. It's that seamless. And I got home and my poor wife was just hysterical because I'm kind of known for being prompt. If I'm going to be somewhere, and I'll be there, I'll be there on time. But this was days before cell phones. You know, she was really concerned. And I could not believe that it was noon until I walked in the house and I heard, you know, Nickelodeon on the TV downstairs. And I'm like, and I just could not believe it. You know, that happened in 1987. Betty came to see me in 2017. She restored some memories for me that I'd always wondered about because it always bugged me. Where did those 2 hours go? Where was I? She explained to me. And then I could see it in my mind's eye play out like a movie in my head. I remember getting off my motorcycle. I had the helmet, holding it by the strap. And in the cornfield to my left, there was a flying saucer. There was a disc. And it was about 10 feet tall. And it was big and about 50 feet in diameter. And it glided over to the road, over the road in front of me, came to a stop about 7 or 8 feet off the ground, I think, and a door opened and a ramp came down. And I walked up this ramp. There was Sue. She was there waiting for me. I walked in and kind of exchanged, "How are you? Nice to see you." Inside this craft, there were rows of seats, like movie theater seats, only they were padded and plastic. And there were no restraints, no seat belts, no lap belts, no nothing like that. And we sat down and I felt motion. About the same motion you would feel in an elevator ride. That's what I felt. And in a matter of minutes, I felt this thing stop. I mean, it wasn't a hard stop. I just became aware that it stopped. It let us out. Ramp went down again and we both walked out. We are walking around what I think is a giant warehouse. It's the only thing I can think of. And this place is absolutely enormous. And she took me down a corridor that had these rows of windows and they were huge. They were like 20 by 20 foot by 60 foot. I thought maybe this is a planetarium or something because I could see just a trillion stars. I also saw, before she could answer my question, where are we? I saw on my right, well, the moon, a big sliver of white on the white side of the moon where there's light. It glows like limestone. And this giant sliver of white rock came from the side, and I thought it was going to hit us. And I freaked out, and she told me, no, 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 don't worry. We're the ones moving. The moon is stationary relative to us. She talked to me, and we talked, and I don't have a clear memory of what we all discussed, but we discussed some stuff. The craft must have, I never felt any motion whatsoever. In the little craft I did, in this saucer-like thing I did, but in this thing, I never felt the slightest bit of motion. This thing must have turned because the stars that I'm looking at, there was a big line of blackness that rose up and took over them. And what it was I think this thing had turned and we were now facing the dark side of the moon. And that's where I believe we were. And we traveled a distance and there was a city. And it was, I mean, it was like flying over LAX, Los Angeles Airport. It was just lots of buildings and lots of lights. And there was this big mushroom-shaped tower that she told me was like a kilometer and a half high. It's like a mile high. But, you know, I'm looking down at these things, and there are buildings. They're collections of buildings, and they mostly look like buildings we'd see here. You know, square windows, doors. Some of the windows are lit, and some of them are not. And I'd say we were probably somewhere around 10,000 feet above them. But I had a good view of them. I didn't realize what looked so out of place, and then it struck me that there were no roads. You know, if you fly into an airport, you can see how cities are laid out on a grid, and there are street lights. You know, everything is lit up, and there was none of that. It was just this collection of buildings. And I saw some kind of heavy mining equipment. And I asked her, I said, what is the heavy mining equipment for? And she said that humanity had people there that were stationed there. Lots of different entities would come there, she said, for the rocks. And I'm perplexed and I'm like, what do you mean for the rocks? She didn't explain it to me. And then a little later on, I did a Google search and came across what's called helium-3. And helium-3 is extremely rare on Earth, but the moon is full of the stuff. And it's locked in moon rocks. If you go to the moon, I noticed there's been a big increase. You know, India, Japan, Russia, China, all these countries have sent probes to the moon. If you could either take these rocks back to Earth and process them or build some kind of processing plant on the moon and just take the gas back, the helium-3 is in this gas and it can be used for cold fusion. So it's a renewable, absolutely clean. The only waste would be whatever energy you use to process the rocks. And it'll run a nuclear reactor without radiation. If anyone wants to look up helium-3 and see that it's a real thing.
Towards the end of the book, there's lots of stories that you've put in there that people have sent you. And I wanted to ask you, what have you learned from reading all these other stories? What does it tell you?
Well, you know, one of the things it told me was that near-death experiences is a thing. I didn't know that. I got a little short, just couple pages devoted somewhere around them in between these stories. I should mention that, yeah, I got, at the time that I wrote this book in 2020, I'd received about 2,200 emails. I've now received about over 4,000. But people write to me and they say, and you know, it's interesting. They'll send me an email and they're all so similar because they all start off with, now this is going to sound crazy and please don't think I'm nuts. And I know you're not going to believe this. And then after that, they tell me these most amazing stories. And they did. And what I found out is that near-death experiences and contact with ET by non-human entities, women waking up missing fetuses. There's just a whole litany of my favorite story is the first one in the back of the book, where the 68-year-old woman and her husband back in the late 60s are driving from Las Vegas to Reno, Nevada, and they saw a Christmas store. And she said that back in that day, back in 1968, there were no Christmas stores. She just thought it was odd. She, her and her husband both pulled over and looked at this place. And she said, pull in, they look like they're open. And she said that there were lights pouring out of the windows. And it was about the size of a small medical building. And it had these twinkling lights wound all around the building. And they're all flashing in different colors. Some are flashing, some are static. And the words Merry Christmas is written above in neon light, green neon light. They noticed that he's looking for a driveway to pull in. There was no driveway. There was nothing in front of this thing but sand and sagebrush, desert. She said, quote, we kind of zoned out for a minute. And then we got back on the road and went to Reno. They didn't talk about it, other than to say he remembered seeing it as made of barn wood. She remembered it being made of red brick. But other than that, they didn't discuss it until it came time to go back home to Las Vegas. And they were going to drive right past the spot again. And she says, let's drive past that crazy Christmas store. I want to see it again. And they drove back in the daytime, and there is no Christmas store. Never had been a Christmas store. Her name was Olivia from Henderson, Nevada. And I asked her, Olivia, do you think what you saw could have been a spaceship? And she says, oh my, that's silly. And she says, you know, maybe. She said, I like this. And I'll mention, she's a well-educated, well-spoken, cognitively intact woman. And she said, you know, at my age, people don't make up fairy tales. She said, I was the first person she told, other than her and her husband sharing the story. Just a lot of interesting stuff going on that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a story I read. A woman was saying that she was having these experiences. And she said when she was small, she used to go and play with a little girl at the end of the street in this house. And when she was an adult, she said to her mum, who was that little girl? Who were those people? And her mum said, there's no house at the end of the street. That was wasteland. There's never been a house there.
Yep. Yeah.
I liked the story about these guys that were hunters. One of them went missing and they went looking for him. And then the next thing they know, they're just waking up in the cabin.
That's an amazing story. That guy's a firefighter in a little city in Texas, not far from where I live. And he's not a fireman anymore. He and family members formed this concrete company. But this is an excellent example of what happens. There were five really good friends. They were all in the firehouse together. They did everything together. They hunted together, fished together, drank together, did everything together. Four of the five went on this trip. This guy named Jeff, his family owned this like a trailer, motorhome kind of thing, out in the middle of nowhere in rural Texas, where they had a lot of wild hogs. And they all bought these high-power branch rifles, and they were going to go down and shoot a couple pigs and come home with a bunch of meat and have a barbecue while they were down there. After this event happened, the whole ride home, they didn't talk about it. And then one gets reassigned, one quits the fire service, one goes another place. Billy, the guy that was there that was the cook, opened a restaurant. But these guys were all close friends, and they all went in different directions. And it's a good example. But, you know, the same thing happened to Toby and I. There is an excellent book written by a guy named Ray Fowler called The Allagash Four. And it talks about a 1973 or 74 event where it's a very similar story to the guys from the firehouse. You know, gang of four guys, two of them were twins, the Weiner twins. Then two other guys, and they went on this fishing trip to the Allagash Lake up off the Allagash River in Maine. They went out, they were going to night fish. And because at night, you know, unless you had some kind of light to sea, you'd never find your campsite again, or at least not until dawn. So they built this humongous fire that would burn for 6 hours. And they went out on their fishing trip and they rowed out to the middle of the lake. They were out 15 minutes and they saw what they thought was the moon, and then it moved and then it lit up the aluminum inside the canoe. That's it. That's all they remember. The next memory they had was paddling back to what is now just a pile of embers, and got back to their campsite. Everybody went to bed. Everybody got up the next morning. Nobody talked about it. They took the long drive home. Everybody split up and they never got together as a group again. So the only way that this became public was, it was a real famous case. One of the twins was having these horrible nightmares. He had even distanced himself from his twin. And you know how close maternal twins are. He started telling his dream to his twin brother, and his twin brother finishes the dream for him. Like, yeah, I got the same dreams. And that's when they saw a psychologist, and the psychologist did some hypnosis, hypnotic regression, and they had an amazing story of abduction.
And I liked it that you started this book with a thing about your friend Toby. Would you be able to just talk about Toby for a little bit, just explain who he is and how it's relevant to be in this book?
Sure. In 1977, I worked in the emergency room at Whiteman Air Force Base as an EMT, drove an ambulance. And I worked the night shift from 11 p.m. to 8 a.m. And Toby and I were a team. I drove the ambulance, he navigated, and we worked together for a little over 2.5 years, I think, total. And he had the bright idea to... This whole camping trip to Devil's Den was his idea. There's something I need to explain. And this is a lot more common than people realize or admit. And that is that here this guy was, my best friend. We were both recently married. Our wives were best friends. You know, on our days off, we'd play cards, we'd play volleyball, we'd do something. So we went to this trip at Devil's Den, and I'll skip all of that drama. We did that last time.
Yeah.
But on the way back, something had changed. And I had trouble reconciling it then, and I can't reconcile it today. But my attitude toward the guy did a complete 360. And I didn't understand that. For some reason, I wanted nothing to do with this guy. And I found out with a little research that that's not that uncommon. We also didn't want to talk about it, which is kind of contrary to human nature. You would think two people that witnessed something, go through something like we did, would be eager to say, man, did you see this? Did you see that? And validate each other's experience. And it wasn't like that. We had about a 6.5 hour drive north to get back to the Air Force base. I think we exchanged maybe a dozen words. We had one conversation. And that was, we agreed that we wouldn't tell a soul, not anyone, what we saw, what this experience was. We wouldn't say that we saw a UFO. We wouldn't say anything about abduction, because we knew from past experience, if you went back and you told someone, and you told an officer, someone in authority, that story, they would send you out for a psychiatric evaluation, and you would not be on active duty, certainly not on a nuclear base. So we both wanted to finish our enlistments because we wanted the GI Bill to pay for college. Yeah, on the way back home, it was a quiet, uncomfortable ride. Now, when we got to the hospital, well, I dropped Toby off at his home. Toby lived about two blocks from me. We both lived in NCO housing on the base. And I went to my house and... my wife was like, oh, hey, you're home early. And I'm like, oh, what happened to you? I said, I don't know. And I had the worst sunburn I'd ever had in my life, but I didn't blister. And his sunburn was everywhere, all over my body. And I had 103 fever, and I was just so dehydrated. I drank all the lemonade I could put my hands on. She said, you're going to have to go to the hospital. And I was resistant to that because that's where I worked. you know, these people at the hospital were my friends. And everybody knew we were making this camping trip. And it would just be kind of embarrassing. But I was so sick, I said, like, that's fine, let's go. So we got there, and it was just half a mile away on base. And we saw Toby's car in the parking lot when we pulled in. So we knew that his wife probably brought him. I went up to the ER, and of course, they got a wheelchair for me, treated me like gold, took very good care of me. But it was unusual in that they put us in separate waiting rooms, or pardon me, examination rooms. So I was in a bigger exam room that had, you know, two beds. And it would have made sense to put us both in there, but they didn't do that. They broke us up. And I found out later that that's very typical for the United States Air Force to do, is that if you have two people, you know, maybe if they see something in the sky dart by, no big deal, tell them to keep their mouths shut. But Toby and I had a more intimate encounter. When people have encounters at that level, the Air Force will routinely break them up, bust them apart, you know. And what they did was they cut orders for Toby to be off base. He was gone in 60 days, and that is light speed, the process orders. Yeah, they gave him orders to Japan, and they gave me a warning. When I was in the exam room just finishing up, the hospital commander, who I knew well, the base commander, who I knew of, but never really had much of a conversation with, or any conversation with, and some guy in civilian clothes I didn't know, the three of them walked into the exam room and asked the doctor to excuse himself, and he did, shut the door on the way out. The hospital commander told me Sergeant Lovelace, you're to have no contact with Sergeant Tobias in any way, shape, or form. You're not to talk to him verbally in person, by telephone, communicate with him by third parties. You're not to give him anything. You're not to accept anything from him. And on and on and on with this big, long litany of things that would be common in a domestic protection order these days. You know, no contact. And the hospital commander said, Sergeant Lovelace, that's an order. If you disobey that order, there'll be consequences. Do you understand that? And I said, yes, sir, I do. Well, I kind of did. I mean, I understood that I was have no contact with Toby, but this change in our relationship, I really didn't care. Although I did want to see him one last time. And I don't think we covered this in the other interview, but I think it's important when we're talking about Toby and our relationship. And that was, I had this idea that I needed to say goodbye to Toby, shake his hand, and wish him well. Because I was struggling straight out of the experience. I was struggling with nightmares, and I thought maybe to see the guy again, we could shake hands, I could wish him well. Maybe I'd get some kind of closure about this whole thing. Well, that was what I was hoping for. We were coming back from the base grocery store one afternoon, and I told my wife, I said, swing by Toby's on the way home. I just want to run in and tell him goodbye. And she told me, she said, Terry, don't screw with these OSI people. They scare me. And I said, yeah, I know. They scare me too. And for those in your audience who might not know what OSI is, OSI stands for the Office of Special Investigations. And it's the investigative branch of the security police for the Air Force Security Services. So, you know, they're like the plainclothes detectives kind of people. That's that we were warned not to have any contact with one another, two OSI agents. So my wife stopped by Toby's house. I hopped out of the car. I ran up to the door, same door I'd been through 100 times before. And I did what I always did. And I knocked three times. I opened the door because it was always unlocked, and said, hey guys, it's me. And I walked in, and Toby's wife just happened to be walking by with a box. They were packing. They were getting ready to leave to go to Japan. And she gave me a hard look and said, you know, you're not supposed to be here. And I said, look, I know I'm not here for any drama. I just want to say goodbye to my friend. And I guess Toby was in the bedroom down the hall and around the corner, because I think he heard my exchange with Tammy, and he came around the corner. Seeing him again, for some reason, I felt uncomfortable, but I felt shocked by his appearance. And that was that this guy, he was always unbelievably neat. I mean, he had nice clothes, he dressed well, always had his hair cut right. He was very particular about his appearance. And I mean, I know he was in the process of moving, so I can cut him some slack with that. But as he came around the corner and down the hall, you know, his hair was all wonky. He had a 3 or 4 day growth of beard, a dirty T-shirt, blue jeans, and he was barefoot. And I just never seen him like that. And he looked sad, hungover, something. He didn't look normal. And he walked up to me, and I'm 6 foot even. He was about 5'7". I held out my hand for a handshake, and we kind of missed each other's hands and finally managed this awkward handshake. And I said, "Hey man, I just want to wish you well. I heard you're going to Japan. It's been good to work with you." And he looked up at me and he said, "It happened, didn't it, Terry?" And I said, "Yes, my brother, it happened. You're not losing your mind. It happened." And he said, "Yeah, but why us?" And I said, "Man, I don't have a clue." And I just turned around and I ran out of the house and back to the car and told my wife, "Let's go home." And, you know, I was hoping to get some closure regarding this thing. And that encounter gave me no closure whatsoever. And that was the last time I saw my friend.
It's been great talking to you again. And we've been talking about the book Devil's Den, The Reckoning, and I advise people to go back, listen to the other episode we recorded. The Incident at Devil's Den is that book, and to get both books because it's so fascinating. And thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you, Simon. Take care.
And that was an interview with Terry Lovelace about his book, Devil's Den, The Reckoning. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 250 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of the Past Lives Podcast every Thursday called Paranormal Stories, and that almost always has UFO information. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is pastlivespodcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. The two of you guys came back and you both ended up at hospital, but he didn't tell them what had happened. You didn't tell them what had happened, but they knew what happened by the way they were treating you.
You know, they absolutely knew. And I have a theory about that. And that is that when we went out to find our own campground, we came to that, there was a chain across.